Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Jobs, Agriculture, and Rural Development Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, March 25th, and please let the record show we do have a quorum. Members, we have a full agenda today, and we do need to be out of this room at 4 o'clock today so that we will make that announcement right at the beginning. Let's begin with the confirmation of Commissioner Mark Phillips for the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board. Mr. Phillips, welcome to the committee, and go ahead whenever you're ready.
So I assume a little background would be helpful?
That'd be perfect.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mark Phillips. A little history. I've worked in economic development for about 35 years, and primarily in northeastern Minnesota, but also somewhat statewide. I was the deed commissioner in the first 2 years of the Dayton administration. So the IRRRB is a state agency, although it operates with taxes that are paid in lieu of property taxes in northeastern Minnesota by the taconite industry. Our mission revolves around a state statute, and it's promote and invest in businesses, communities, and the workforce in northeastern Minnesota. I mentioned how we are funded. Our service territory is about 13,000 square miles in northeastern Minnesota. Involves 50 cities, 129 townships, and 15 school districts. We're governed by a board of directors that's made up of state representatives and state senators that have, I believe, a third of their constituents within that geographic boundary. Our activities primarily are in business development, community development, as I mentioned, and workforce development. With that, I guess I would take questions.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Are there any questions for Commissioner Phillips? Senator Rood.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
I do have a couple questions. My district is directly impacted by the IRRRB. And before you were appointed, there were some issues. And I think I'd like to get your take on those issues and how they're going to be resolved and some of the transparency issues. Specifically, the use of the Meyer Associates, I think there was a big article in the Star and Tribune on that, and also the Range Trust. And I'd like to just address how that is working. I think I saw that in order for that to go forward, the board had to pick some trustees, adopt bylaws, and that. And could you just give me an overview of where you are on that and how you feel about those issues going forward?
Commissioner Phillips?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rood, two things. I just touched on the Myers loan. It was done in 2006. So it wasn't just before I was appointed. It was, you know, almost a decade before I was appointed. But it was done really out in the open and vetted. I didn't bring the articles with me, but I did some research and found out that the revelation that was on the Star Tribune was actually made back in 2006, and it was publicly vetted. So I think that certainly. It wasn't a transparency issue or a conflict of interest in any way, but having said that, I guess I'm sensitive to businesses that might do business in the world of politics. When I worked at Iron Range Resources, we denied a loan to WELY, the radio station in Ely, because they used to carry ads for Doug Johnson's campaign, so we denied them a loan. That was about 1984. So, you know, I understand the issue on that, but to me it was a non-issue. This has made the front page of the paper in 2006, so I didn't think it was a revelation in 2015. So the Range Trust is a bigger issue. And the assets of IRRRB, again, these are taxes that are paid in lieu of property taxes. So I don't know what county each one of you reside in, but when the legislature tried to balance the budget back in 2010, a bill passed to take $60 million of our local property taxes to balance the state budget. And that's really the issue, is about preserving the assets. So I think the Rage Trust was approved. We have not moved forward with anything. We're going to be very cautious of how we do it. But I think the idea of preserving the assets from in future legislators to balance the state budget with our local property taxes, I think is an important issue that we are going to do very carefully.
Senator Root.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. We'll be looking, you know, forward to those hearings and to hearing how, you know, you move forward with that. I'm excited that you have a very good assistant commissioner there, and I appreciate the fact that we'll be working closely together. I represent all of Aiken County and Crow Wing County, so and I would appreciate. You know, I have 30,000 constituents in the IRRRB, and I'm probably for the first time the senator that represents the Cuyuna Iron Range doesn't sit on the IRRRB. And so I'd really appreciate it if going forward that you could keep me in the loop and maybe I could have notices of your meetings, and I'd really like to, I would appreciate more involvement from the senator from that district.
Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to keep you in the loop.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Any further questions for Commissioner Phillips? Seeing none, Senator Rood, would you like to move?
I would be honored to move.
Okay. Senator Rood moves the confirmation of Mark Phillips as the Commissioner of the Iron Range Resource and Rehabilitation to the Senate floor with a recommendation to confirm. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much,
Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. Thank you to the committee.
Next on the agenda, members, we have the Commissioner of Agriculture, the Department of Agriculture, Commissioner Fredrickson. When you're welcome, welcome back to the committee, Commissioner, and proceed whenever you're ready.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm pleased to be here today to go through the confirmation process with the committee. It's an important process, and I'm happy to be here. For the record, Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Dave Fredrickson. I serve as the Commissioner of Agriculture. I have served in that capacity for the last 4 years. The governor was foolish enough to invite me to stick around for another term, and I foolishly said yes. So that's why I'm here again, asking for your confirmation. Briefly, I was the middle child of three, went off to college. My father's health failed, came back home to the farm in 1974 and farmed there for 25 years, raising a couple of daughters and several cats and dogs. And in the meantime, became involved politically, served a couple of terms in the Minnesota Senate. And this room hasn't changed any since 25 years ago. And I haven't gotten any older either, which is nice. I chose to leave of my own free will, recognizing that every now and then an innocent person is sent to serve, and exited to go back to the farm. I was sidetracked to the farm organization, Minnesota Farmers Union, expected to stay maybe a couple of months to fill Senator Eakin's father's term, Willis, and that turned into nearly 11 years. In the meantime, continued to farm the land in Swift County. I then ran for the presidency of the National Farmers Union Organization and accidentally won and served two terms as the NFU president based in Denver and in Washington, D.C., and here in the Twin Cities. I was driving to a little town out in western Minnesota in, I think it was 2006 and or 5 or 6, and I fell asleep at the wheel in Hutchinson, or just out of Hutchinson. I thought about getting a cup of coffee there and chose not to. I fell asleep at the wheel and rear-ended a grain truck. I was on my way to a little town called Woodstock, not the one that Senator Dames remembers, but the one out in western Minnesota.
And taking shots early.
Actually, if you say you remember Woodstock, Senator, you weren't there.
Uh,
I took that as a sign and felt that maybe I should think about retirement. I was of retirement age at the time. A few months later, I was flying from Mexico City back to the Twin Cities, and the airplane was struck by lightning, and this huge ball of fire went out underneath, and I thought to myself, I've had a sign. I'm out of it. And so I retired, went home, stared out the window for the better part of a year. My wife said, do you remember the vows we took? I said, I do. You remember the one about in sickness and in health? I do. I'm okay with that, she said. Do you remember the one about until death do us part? I said, I do. I'm okay with that, too. However, I am not okay with you being home for lunch, so go find something to do. Our senior senator was elected at that time, and I went to work for Amy, Senator Klobuchar. I'm sorry, Amy, Senator Klobuchar, and spent the first 4 years of her first term with her working on public policy issues and outreach work for her. I then transitioned over to the Department of Agriculture when Governor Dayton was elected, and I have been here ever since. If I had a lot of sense, I would retire with my age group, but I lack common sense in terms of my continuing to work. So I want to talk just briefly about the work that the department does. Our vision has been and continues to be at the department to enhance food safety, also to ensure environmental quality, and also to increase profitability for farmers all across the state and its related entities and industries. And I think about that vision statement on a daily basis as we go through the process of the work at the department. We are the Minnesota Ag and the food industry is this state's second largest employer. We support more than 340,000 Minnesota jobs and create $90 billion in economic activity statewide. In the past 4 years, we've moved from fourth to third to the third largest ag exporting state. The value of Minnesota ag products exceeds over $8 billion. We certified 2 billion pounds of ag products for export in 2014, which interestingly is a 66% increase from 2013. So we're just talking about increased tonnage here, not value tonnage, which is substantial. Through the AgriFund program that you have graciously provided the department, we have invested $18.25 million in livestock farms, ag and food businesses, ag research, the next generation of Minnesota farmers, also increases in research and production of the next generation of biofuels. We have $5.5 million of investment in 328 Minnesota livestock farms, leveraging over $125 million in projects. We support them to the tune of 10%, and they come in with their own money and the bank's money for 90%. So it's a great partnership, and I think a great use of AgriFunds. We have $3.2 million of investment in value-added businesses, matching $13.6 million in private investment, a 4-to-1 return on investments that create 46 new full-time and 76 new part-time jobs. We have a serious investment in biofuels, something that I go back many, many years with in that I was here during the time that the ethanol mandate was developed here in Minnesota, and I think one has to look back on those 25-plus years and say, you know, we've done very well in ethanol production here in Minnesota. You know, the vision in 1987 was if we could come up with a way to create an opportunity to produce 100 million gallons of ethanol, we would totally have covered our need as a state. We were burning 1 billion gallons of regular gasoline in 1987. Today we have capacity to produce over 1 billion gallons of ethanol in the state of Minnesota in 21 plants across the agricultural L of Minnesota. Our ag water quality program, again, a ag water quality certification program. To date, we have 31 farms representing a little over 12,000 acres that have been certified with 84 new conservation practices. Over 260 producers are moving through the certification process presently. In January, USDA announced a program that we had applied for under the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, and we were fortunate to receive a $9 million grant from USDA to further grow the Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program across Minnesota. I spent some time last December addressing the Surface Transportation Board in Fargo on issues and changes in the shipping process and to encourage railroads to make the infrastructure improvements needed to alleviate major delays that cause millions of dollars in losses to Minnesota farmers. And I'm pleased to say that BNSF and other rails have stepped to the plate and have increased their commitment to infrastructure development across Minnesota. So let me say the state of agriculture is in good shape. We're struggling right now with prices. I see in my home community, corn is $3.50 a bushel. Now, 25 years ago, that was a good price. Today, not so much. So we will continue to struggle with input costs, land values. That's a concern of mine as you watch land go from $450 an acre to approaching $10,000 an acre. And I don't know, you know, when that bubble will burst. I hope it doesn't. I hope that we can flatten out those highs and lows as we move across the economic sector of production agriculture in Minnesota. I know you have a tight schedule today, Mr. Chairman, so I'm happy to take any questions that you might have at this point.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Commissioner, for your leadership in agriculture. Any questions for the Commissioner at this time? Senator Dames.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, I was going to ask Mr. Chairman, not from him.
Senator Dames.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and this really isn't a question. It's just a comment. As I understand, and Commissioner Kerfredrickson can correct me if I'm wrong, as I understand, it's his responsibility and duties to manage all wild boars that show up in Minnesota. So I understand he's also out pushing pretty hard on the buffer strip legislation. So I would assume the only reason I can come up that he would possibly support that is he feels that's a good safe haven for wild boars, and that way he would have something to do because apparently he's looking for things to do. Well, so I can understand that's the only reason I can come up with why you'd support that, but I'll let you go on that one. Oh, by the way, that Woodstock deal, you know what you don't understand is I was heading to a church convention and I got lost and I was over by Woodstock when you ran me off the road because you heard there was only one parking spot left. So what goes around comes around, Commissioner.
Commissioner?
Senator Dames always gets the last word.
Yeah. Right. Very good. No, seriously, you are doing a good job. We're honored to have you there, and I think continue to do the good work that you do. Any further questions? If not, Senator Hurt, I'm sorry. Senator Hurt.
Sorry for squeezing in and make my word the last word. But, you know, I since you both mentioned about Woodstock, you know, I'm a little younger then, and the only Woodstock that I remember is Snoopy's friend. But I want to make a comment in support of Commissioner for, you know, working with diversity as well. You know, there's a plot of land down in Santa Clausen District that was, you know, used as a pilot program for the Hmong American Farmer Association. And even though it go under the name Hmong American, it actually, you know, have expanded clientele to Hispanic community and to Somali members as well. And I commend you for the good work and the welcomeness to make that happen.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hare, thank you very much. And it's a pleasure and a joy to work with the community.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, Senator Dames moves the confirmation of Dave Fredrickson as Commissioner of the Department of Agriculture to the Senate floor with recommendation to confirm. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Congratulations.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members.
All right, Senator Sparks, we have Senate File 1459 in front of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 1459 is the Department of Agriculture policy bill. Mr. Chair and members, I do have the author's amendment that I'd like to offer to get the bill in the shape we would like, so I would offer the A to delete all author's amendment at this time.
All right, Senator Sparks moves the A2 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, this is the department's policy provisions, and the amendment we adopted stays true to that by subtracting unneeded language, technical adjustments, and some language changes to reflect stakeholder participation addressing possible concerns. I know we have a tight schedule today, so I believe I'll just turn it over to Santo Cruz through the Department of Ag to run through the provisions within the bill and then open it up for amendments at that time.
Welcome to the committee, sir, if you don't mind stating your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Santo Cruz, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I do want to be respectful of the tight schedule today, so if you don't mind, we'll jump right in. If you look at page one of the amendment, there is an adjustment to the loans issued through the Ag BMP program. This proposal is basically moving the amount in loan from $100,000 to $200,000. The program provides low-cost financing to farmers, farm suppliers, and rural landowners to implement best management practices that improve water quality. Qualified loans may be for feedlot improvements, manure storage basins, conservation tillage, and many other practices. The reason for this request is that the cost of the eligible projects continue to increase. In recent years, counties and participating lenders have requested that the maximums be increased. The Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts, by a resolution of its members, requested that MDA develop this legislative initiative, and this reflects that resolution. So what I'd like to do now is move into our Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division and have Mr. Joe Spitzmuller come forward and run through the next set of policy and technical items in as abbreviated a form as he can.
All right. Well, welcome to the committee, if you don't mind stating your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe Spitzmuller. I'm a manager in the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division of the department. Mr. Chair, I'll start out section – I'm going to be talking about section 1, and that's covered in lines 1.3 to lines 1.24. This is a permanent efficiency goal and report. The department is currently required to submit a semiannual permitting efficiency goals report. The permit issuance times over the past several years by the division have been consistently within the requirements of the statute. This proposal changes the reporting requirements to an annual report. The change in reporting requirement obviously will reduce our administrative efforts to create two reports each year, thereby creating efficiencies within the agency. I'll move to Section 3 and Section 4. These are lines covered in lines 2.13 to 3.7 and lines 3.8 to 3.18, and these deal with the Waste Pesticide Collection Program. The Waste Pesticide Collection Program is responsible for the collection and safe disposal of 5.8 million pounds of old, unusable, and out-of-condition pesticides since the program began in 1990. The MDA was directed to analyze the collection data on over 187,000 collected products gathered over the last 4 years to identify trends and inform future collection strategies to better meet the nature of the current waste stream. The provision sets forth changes to revise the program strategies in order to improve collection operations and efficiency. It sets new limits on record-keeping guidelines and creates more scheduling flexibility that provides MDA an opportunity to better target collection needs and focus resources. The MDA has met with representatives of County Solid Waste Administrators. These are our partners in this endeavor. The Association of Minnesota Counties and representative of Metro Counties about these proposals. The proposal has been vetted and agreed to by our county partners. I'll move to sections 5 and 6, which are covered in lines 3.19 to 4.13 and line 4.14 to 5.6. This is pesticide application records. So commercial and structural pesticide application records are important documents that track pesticide applications. This proposal modifies record-keeping requirements, changing some of the formatting and content requirements to promote electronic record keeping and to establish a completion deadline. Again, this change will promote greater use of electronic records and establish clear completion deadlines for applicators. With that, I'll move to lines section 7 and section 9. Those are covered in lines 5.7 to 5.22 and lines 5.13 to 6.15. These relate to an incident response plan. Response plans and other emergency preparedness measures are critical protections to workers, the public, and our environment from accidents, spills, and other incidents that result in agricultural chemical releases. This proposal aligns multiple reference to response plans in statute and establishes uniform plan standards. I'll move to Section 8. This section is previously covered under the trade secrets provisions of the Data Practices Act. We would ask that this section be deleted. Finally, I'll move to Section 10. This is the discontinuation of specialty fertilizer registration. This is a provision. When a fertilizer registration ends, product sales must stop immediately. When a distributor cancels a registration, a retailer may be caught unaware with a product in inventory that cannot be legally sold. This proposal establishes a discontinuation registration period after the distributor notifies the MDA of cancellation. This requires the distributor to renew the registration of the fertilizer for a two-year period whereby the retailer can continue selling this product that is already in the channels of trade. Legal sale eliminates remaining product from the retailer's inventory through legal sale and use. This provision replicates existing language in the pesticide law about registration cancellation, which has successfully reduced the number of unregistered pesticides in the channels of trade. And that concludes my testimony.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you. I think, did you talk about Section 9? I didn't hear that.
Yes,
Section 9. Mr. Spitzmuller.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. Yes, Section 7 and Section 9 both cover the incident response plan. Section 7 relates to the provision that's contained in the pesticide law, and Section 9 relates to the provision as contained in the fertilizer law. So those are the two pieces we're trying to align.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may, call
Please.
Up Mr. Guillafrizeau to talk about the following section. I believe we're on page 7 and 8, the very bottom of page 6, actually, is section 11, then picking up into page 7. So with that, if Mr. Guillafrizeau could take over.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, if you don't mind stating your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Guillafrizeau. I'm the director of the Plant Protection Division. I also try and be very brief with the pieces that cover my division. Most of these technical changes have been reviewed with our seed advisory committee, and they are supportive of these changes. First change is Section 11, starting with line 7.1. This simply clarifies that an address for the label is a complete address, not simply the city and state. Section 12, line 7.6, this provides a definition of what total viable seed is, and this just brings Minnesota in conformity with some standard national standards that defines what viable total viable seed is. Section 13, line 8.21. Wait, I'm sorry, I got the wrong. Yeah, Section 13, 18.21 is to reword the section that allows labelers to use the terminology total viable instead of a rather lengthy phrase that is required to be put on labels now. And so this simply makes a much easier and shorter terminology for labelers. Section 14, line 8.34, this is actually moving some verbiage from rule into statute, and it's allowing or requiring that the relative maturity for hybrid seed corn has to be within 3 days of the testing or comparative trials that are run by the University of Minnesota. Section 15, line 9.7, this is simply intended to clarify that the seed association rules for testing seed are used for official samples. And this is the current practice, but we just wanted to make sure it was clearly understood within statute. Section 16, beginning with line 9.15, this allows the commissioner to designate seeds that are considered prohibited or restricted, and this makes us match up with the noxious weed law, which also allows the commissioner to designate noxious weeds, and this simplifies the process of making that designation. Section 17, beginning with line 9.3, this is a section that was intended to address a situation that we became aware of just a few months ago regarding the interpersonal sharing of seed for home or educational or charitable uses, and the most best example was the Duluth Library, and we wanted to be sensitive to that, so this provides an exemption to allow that sort of interpersonal sharing, but with the caveat that the exemption would be repealed if the seed was either patented, protected, or had been misrepresented as certified seed, or if it contained prohibited or restricted seed. Section 18, line 10.16, this is adding to our definition of what initial labelers who sell native grasses and wildflower seed in commercial or agricultural quantities. So this would be primarily people who are providing seed for seeding, for example, MnDOT land or large acreages. And then I'm going to skip ahead to Section 20, the last piece that involves my division. Section 20, line 13.04, simply clarifies that when people storing grain are reporting that to us, that if the grain is being stored in the open, that is also subject to the reporting requirements on an annual basis. So includes my part.
Okay, thank you, sir.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, I believe Senator Sparks has an oral amendment, and then I'll finish up the rest of the testimony on the bill. There's just a few other provisions left.
Very well. Senator Sparks?
Mr. Chair and members, and as the previous testifier said, the department would like to delete Section 8. So if Mr. Knopf could help me, if we could just do that orally at this time, that would be wonderful.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sparks, I think if you just turn to page 5, so it would be at page 5, delete Section 8. It would be as simple as that.
All right. Senator Sparks moves the oral amendment. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, if I may continue.
Yes, please proceed.
Thank you. On page 10 at the bottom, embargo, seizure, and condemnation. One of the issues we have in the area of food safety is when we're able to condemn food, sometimes the reason why we're condemning it or we have a food safety concern is because of the equipment itself. So if you have a faulty freezer, a faulty mixer, if something's contaminated, sometimes that is, in fact, the root of the problem. So this basically allows us to tag those pieces of equipment to basically stop the problem from continuing. I'd move on to page 12, subdivision 7 of the same section, emergency powers. This has really come up really in the last few weeks. As you may be aware, Mr. Chair, and members, we had a breakout of high path avian influenza for the first time in Minnesota a couple weeks ago in Polk County. And what we realized in that response was that the Board of Animal Health had the emergency powers it needed to be able to depopulate the infected and quarantined birds in that situation. The Department of Agriculture had the equipment and the personnel, but the plan and the authority came from the Board of Animal Health. It was very quickly realized that should anything get into the food supply, whether it be eggs or any other poultry products, the Department of Agriculture and the Commissioner of Agriculture would have the same responsibility the board had for the animals, but not the same emergency powers, basically to stop the flow of food or permit it in and out of the quarantine zone. So this is really just making sure that should anything happen, and we hope that we never need this, but we hoped we never needed the authority through the Board of Animal Health either, that we'd be able to respond as we did with the Polk County situation. And with that, Chair and members, I would conclude.
Well, thank you, sir. Any further discussion or questions, comments? Anybody else in the audience like to speak to the bill? All right. Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an oral amendment. On page 13, line 24, before and, we would insert 18H-02, subdivision 28, A through J. What this deals with, Mr. Chair and members, is this is the language dealing with pollinator lethal insecticides. And this language is very, very loosely drawn language. It doesn't have any targets. It's very vague. It doesn't say how and when we will determine when a plant is considered to be lethal. And this was passed in the House last year, and the concern I have is that we're going to start asking people when they apply for money through Legacy or LCCMR, we're going to insist they meet this, and it's really going to be hard to do that because the terms and the facts just aren't there. We don't have any limits. We don't know. We don't describe what a lethal plant is. We don't have any targets, and it's very vague. So that's why I'm asking for this to be repealed.
All right. Well, thank you, Senator Dames. Mr. Knopf, would you mind clarifying the oral amendment as stated by Senator Dames?
Mr. Chair, I think I'll restate it. That I want to make sure it's clear what exactly it is being repealed. It's basically so on page 13, line 24, before the and, insert 18H.02, subdivision 28A, semicolon. That's the amendment. So it would add a repealer of that section of statutes, 18H.02, subdivision 28A. And as Senator Dames pointed out, that was a definition added last year of pollinator lethal insecticide to chapter 18H.
Thank you, Mr. Knopf. Senator Sparks, would you like to speak to this or
Mr. Chair and members, I don't have real strong feelings either way. If this helps Senator Dames, I guess we can allow the committee to decide, but we can take it forward, certainly go to conference committee and have further discussions if that's okay with members.
Any additional question on the oral amendment? Seeing none, Senator Dames, you move the oral amendment as stated. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Any additional discussion, members? All right, Senator Sparks, we'd like to move your... Oh, yes, Senator Coonan.
I have an amendment, Mr. Chairman, the A4 amendment.
The A4 amendment. Our staff will be passing that out. Okay. And in the meantime, Senator Coonan, would you like to speak to the amendment?
Yes, and what this amendment... the subject area is the minimum wage, and it addresses the minimum wage on salaried workers for farms. And there's a part of Minnesota law that uses a formula to determine the minimum wage for salaried workers. And the way the formula works, it runs the salaried workers' minimum wage ahead much faster than the typical minimum wage. And so I'll give you an example here. For the first adjustment that was made on August 1st of 2014, the minimum wage went from $7.25 to $8 an hour, which is just short of a 10.5% increase. The salaried wage for farm employees went from $452 per week up to $588 a week, which is a little over a 30% increase. So you can see it's going up much faster than the typical minimum wage. And so what this amendment does is changes... Well, first of all, what it does is lock in that 588 until we get past the last adjustment in the minimum wage law on August 1st of 2016. And then after that, the inflator kicks in. And so what this bill does then is locks in that salary at $588 per week and holds it there until we get to the point in time where the inflator will kick in, and then it'll go up from there along with the rest of the minimum wage. And the minimum wage then at on the hourly rate will be $9.50 per hour then. And if you look at the minimum wage before the current law kicked in, it was $7.25. And by August 1st of 2016, it'll be $9.50 per hour, which is about a 31% increase. So that's about the same as the single increase that took place last year. So everything will be equal then. And then at that point, the inflator will kick in, and we'll move forward from that point. And then also, if you look at line 1.7, current law has two or fewer specified individuals, employees, are exempt in current law. That moves that up to five, and the reasoning for that is it would help address some of the smaller farms that they would be exempt from the minimum wage laws in Minnesota. Now, I don't. What that does is recognize that smaller farmers have, you know, issues that larger farmers don't, as far as being able to afford the higher help. But I don't think, in my experience, when I was a dairy farmer, we always had to pay above minimum wage or you just couldn't get the help. And I suspect that'll be true in this case. So this isn't as severe as it sounds on its face. But anyway, that's a general quick overview of what the amendment does, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Coonan. Senator Fuller has a. I'm sorry, Senator. God, we I don't know if that's a demotion or what, but Mr. Fuller, you have a suggestion?
Mr. Chair, on line 1.2, change A1 to A2.
Okay.
Just a minor. What was that?
We're actually amending an amendment, so so it's on line 1.2, A2 versus A1, making that technical change. Any further discussion on Senator Coonan's amendments? Senator Sparks, would you like to speak to it?
Mr. Chair and members, Senator Coonan, thank you for bringing the amendment. I know that the minimum wage does hit the ag sector a little bit harder, especially with the escalators. It's a fairness issue. Again, realizing this is the last train leaving the station, I'll leave it up to the committee, but we can add this to the bill and have some further discussion going forward if members choose to do so.
Okay. Any further discussion, members? All right, Senator Coonan moves his amendments, the A4 amendment. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Any further discussion, members? All right, well, Senator Sparks, would you like to move Senate File 1459 as amended?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move. Thank you. The Senate File 1459 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor.
All right. Any further discussion, members? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Moving on. All right, Senate File 736 is up next. Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And we're moving on to Senate File 736. That's correct, Mr. Chair?
That's right, Senator Sparks.
Okay. Members, first of all, I'd like to offer the A4 delete all everything authors amendment to that bill.
Members, the A4 should be in your packets.
No, it's relevant, right?
And Senator Sparks, if you'd like to speak to it at all, or
Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 736 was introduced early this session. It was heard in this committee and given a full vetting in February, and we have since had numerous stakeholder meetings. I appreciate all the parties that been willing to work with us, including the Department of Commerce, AARP, Legal Aid, and members of their coalition. These groups laid out numerous number of concerns and sought clarity that consumer protections, including carrier of last resort, rates, and disconnections would still be addressed through government regulatory measures. I have provided members today with a document that addresses a number of these issues and references the statutes and rules that would still apply should this bill move forward. These and other consumer protections will still be in place if the legislation becomes law. For that reason, I feel comfortable moving forward with the legislation today, Mr. Chair. The proposal acknowledges that consumers have choice, and while the alternatives may not always be identical, they are clearly a substitute. Ultimately, the consumers maintain their ability to choose traditional landline services, but telephone companies do not have to be regulated under regulations that were adopted when they were the only option available. In the interest of time, I know we have a busy agenda and we only have less than an hour to go. I would like to have Ms. Rice come up to discuss some of the changes that we've made since the committee last heard the bill. And then we can take members' questions at that time.
And Senator Sparks, perhaps before hearing testimony, would you like to move the A4 author's amendment to get this bill in the shape you'd like?
Please, Mr. Chair.
All right. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Rice, if you don't mind stating your name and proceeding.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carrie Rice from Inventus Telecom. I was here a month ago when you first addressed this bill, and it's a pleasure to be back in St. Paul from my company's headquarters in Mankato. When we first discussed this bill a month ago, it was important for me to give you background on Inventus, and I want to very briefly do that again because I do think it's germane to this legislation. So just a reminder, I don't appear here representing only an incumbent local exchange carrier. Inventus operates three such companies in the state of Minnesota, and they are members of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, or MTA. But what's important to this legislation is that we also operate three competitive local exchange companies. And our competitive carriers offer a wide variety of services, including basic residential local exchange services. So we operate six companies providing the same services, but we operate under two different sets of rules. This bill would give us an opportunity to seek to align the way we operate to the single set of competitive rules. So by now you understand that the mechanics of this bill is to put in place a process whereby incumbent carriers can demonstrate competition and thereafter be regulated like their Minnesota PUC regulated competitors. You heard concerns from a variety of parties at the last hearing, and we, and by this I mean the industry and the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, have been hard at work to address those, as Senator Sparks alluded to. Here are some of the changes that have been agreed to. The competitive test is now narrowed to wire center. The size has been decreased twice to accommodate concerns. The length of time for the Public Utilities Commission to review the petition has tripled to 180 days. Language has been added to address concerns about wholesale provisions. Again, that's very important to my company since we do compete with some of the larger companies. We've overbuilt exchanges of CenturyLink and Frontier. We want those wholesale provisions in there. That's good. The definition of competitive services provider has changed, and the competitive test language has changed. Now, we know that there are additional changes parties would like to see. And I am here to offer you the Minnesota Telecom Alliance's assurance that when this bill passes out of committee, as we hope it does today, that we will continue to work with stakeholders to find language that either eliminates or minimizes their concerns. So I want to move quickly to what this bill does not do, because I think you're going to hear some of those concerns this afternoon. It does not grant a telephone company the ability to disconnect or stop serving customers without PUC approval. My Inventus CLEC companies can't do that today, so if my ILEX were granted this market-based regulation, they would also not be able to do this. Related to that is the concern that ILEX will or could be relieved of their obligation to serve any requesting customer. This is often referred to as a carrier of last resort or COLR obligation. This bill does not change any law in this area or eliminate statutes the Department of Commerce has indicated it believes constitute COLR obligations. The bill does not limit the ability of the PUC to approve a price increase. It does not eliminate or alter the ability of the PUC and the Department of Commerce to have investigative authority over telcos, and it doesn't eliminate any service quality rules. You know, many other states, including our neighbors to the north and east, Iowa and Wisconsin, have modernized their telecom laws, and they go much further than what you're being asked to do today. So we're not breaking any new ground. 736 is a modest step. It is not deregulation. It's an effort to treat similar services the same. This is something that even AARP's members agree with. In 2013, AARP surveyed its members about telecom issues, and guess what? 3/4 of the respondents said the same laws and rules should apply to all landline telephone services, regardless of the technology used to deliver the service. And that's just what we're trying to do here today. There's no public policy reason for your home service from a telephone company to be regulated differently than your neighbor's telephone service from a cable company. I'd like to thank Senator Sparks for his time, his patience, and his assistance in bringing this bill forward, and I'm happy to respond to any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Rice. Any questions among the committee? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rice, you covered something very quickly that has been very important to me and my constituents, and I'm hoping you can just go through that little segment one more time.
Okay.
And that has to do with the concern oftentimes seniors have voiced to me that they are afraid that somehow this legislation might make it such that there is no longer a landline offered for which they can use. And so I just would like you to clarify if that is not the case, and what obligations still remain in place that will ensure that landlines remain available for those who want them.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Senator, thank you. I'll go back maybe a little more slowly over what is the carrier of last resort obligations. So as incumbent local exchange companies, we have been designated by the state of Minnesota, I believe it's a federal program, as an eligible telecommunications carrier. And as that designation holds with it the obligation to serve any customer within our exchange territories who requests service. It is never our intention to abrogate or diminish that obligation in any way, and this language, this bill, does not do that. So any customer in our exchange territory that wants our service will receive our service.
Senator Nelson.
And just to clarify, and that could be a landline.
Ms. Rice.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? Senator Sparks, would you like to bring some more testifiers to the table? Do you have anyone else today, or shall we open it up?
That's the end of my portion of Senate File 736. I don't know if the committee would like to put the bill together and then hear from some other witnesses. I know that there's a few other amendments, if we'd like to do that, or if you just want to stay focused on this part.
Perhaps we can hear the amendments. That could bring some clarity to the discussion before us. Any amendments? Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the A7 amendment.
All right. Staff will be passing that out.
And I would actually ask Mr. Mendoza if he would go to the tables so that he can take the members through it. But as it's being passed out, members, this amendment essentially make sure that as this industry grows and we create an environment where we can innovate in this area, that we make sure that we join the right now 30 other states that have committed to not having a patchwork of regulation, that in fact we set forward a foundation that says we want to make sure that Minnesota is able to compete with our neighboring states to provide the best service that we possibly can. So with that, I'll let Mr. Mendoza take us through the specific amendment.
Welcome to the committee, if you don't mind stating your name and proceeding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, committee members. My name is Tony Mendoza. I am counsel to the Minnesota Cable Communications Association, and I'm pleased to be here to speak in support of the A7 amendment. Senators, Minnesota will be celebrating the 100-year anniversary of Chapter 237, the chapter that established regulation of telephone services in Minnesota. These laws date back to an era when there was one provider of telephone service and no federal telecommunications regulatory scheme. It'd be an understatement to say today that the telecommunications industry is vastly different, perhaps unrecognizable to someone that was alive in 1915. Today, there are myriad ways of communicating with one another: voice calls, texting, email, video conferencing, and social media, and the market for all of these services is extremely competitive. Historically, telephone calls were made using circuit switch technology, When you pick up the phone and dial, you had a circuit dedicated to your call. But internet technology has fundamentally changed the way we make telephone calls and the competitive landscape for voice communication services. Today, many companies now provide phone service using the same technology that providers of email, texting, and other web applications use now. Instead of tying up a circuit for one phone call, voice calls are packetized into data, transported via broadband, and miraculously reassembled at the other end to allow you to talk in real time with the person you've dialed. This technology has come to be known as Voice over Internet Protocol, or VoIP technology, and it runs, like other applications, over broadband networks. At the federal level, a critical and prescient distinction between broadband services information services like VoIP and email and texting was made in the 1960s in a series of decisions called the Computer Inquiries. To spare you a lot of geek law mumbo-jumbo, the essence of those decisions boils down to this. The act of transporting information and the act of processing information are two different things and should be regulated differently. The distinction in the Computer Inquiries case evolved into two definitions under the Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996, telecommunication services, or transport, and information services, or processing. You may have heard something lately about a decision that the FCC just released called the Open Internet, or the Net Neutrality Order. In that order, the FCC categorized broadband, not VoIP, as the act of transporting information. Services falling into this transport category, like broadband, are now subject to greater federal regulatory oversight under the Net Neutrality Order. But services that fall into that other category, data processing, email, texting, and web surfing, are unregulated information services. Today, the popular way we refer to them is as apps. The FCC and federal courts have preempted states from applying common carrier-style regulations to apps. There is no more justification for applying burdensome century-old telephone regulations to apps like VoIP than there is for applying those laws and regulations to email, texting, data processing, or social media. Senators, today earlier in the effort on this bill, you may have heard opponents talk about how many hundreds of thousands of consumers might be affected by this bill, with the implication that that impact could be negative. But consider, according to the FCC, at the end of 2013, there were more than 852,000 VoIP subscriber lines in Minnesota receiving service from 116 VoIP providers. 465,000 of those lines were residential, 387,000 were business. And these numbers have likely increased since then. But in all of 2014, the two top VoIP providers in the state, and this is a filing that was made recently by the Minnesota Department of Commerce, received only 22 customer complaints from the two largest providers in Minnesota. And many of these complaints had little or possibly nothing to do with VoIP services. With this amendment, the VoIP bill will not eliminate carrier of last resort obligations because it will now be combined with the bill that you just heard about from Ms. Rice, and that will maintain a lot of the consumer protections that some parties have warned about. 29 states have adopted VoIP regulation reform. No one in those states is losing access to their phone or their landline service, and to the contrary, with the expansion of broadband to rural areas, more people will have access to VoIP and other phone services, not less. VoIP provides an incentive for broadband investment in rural areas. We've also, I understand, been able to resolve concerns over access to the 911 network and the compliance of VoIP providers with not the state's 911 requirements. The law today could not be more clear that VoIP providers have to comply with 911. The FCC required VoIP providers to comply with 911 laws back in 2005. Congress has also passed something called the Net 911 Act and delegated states with authority to impose state-specific regulations that require compliance with 911 plans.
with respect to TAP and the Telephone Assistance Plan and the Telecommunications Access Minnesota Plan. This amendment will strengthen those programs by ensuring that more VoIP providers pay into those funds. Today, many do not. And finally, with respect to wholesale protections, I understand the stakeholders have worked with the proponents and the authors of the bill to strengthen provisions related to the Commission's authority over wholesale services and the wholesale market and interconnection among carriers. The Minnesota Cable Communications Association represents the largest competitive wireline carriers in the state. We need the ability to interconnect with one another, and the amendment includes protections that satisfy the association's members that wholesale services and interconnection will continue to be enforceable by the State Public Utilities Commission. The Federal Telecom Act of 1996 says this: "It is the policy of the United States to preserve the vibrant and competitive free market that presently exists for the Internet and other interactive computer services, unfettered by federal and state regulation." And the FCC has said this about VoIP regulation: "We cannot permit more than 50 different jurisdictions to impose traditional common carrier economic regulations, such as Minnesota's — this was a case involving Vonage — and still meet our responsibility to realize Congress's objective." The FCC has said it. It wants a national uniform policy in this area, and this amendment will align Minnesota with that national uniform policy. The Minnesota Cable Communications Association strongly supports the amendment. It ensures investment and development in technologies like VoIP and other IP services are not restrained by century-old legacy common carrier regulations, and aligns Minnesota with the FCC's goal to have a nationwide uniform policy with respect to VoIP, while at the same time protecting important state interests such as a high-quality 911 network, telephone assistance programs, and the Telecommunications Access Minnesota program, as well as the seamless interconnection of telecommunications networks. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee has.
Thank you, Mr. Mendoza. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you. Just one follow-up before I turn it back to Senator Sparks. I just want to make sure members know in your packet there's a material that shows who has supported this particular provision: the Twin West Chamber of Commerce, the High Tech Association, Minnesota Chamber, St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce, Duluth Area Chamber of Commerce, Chamber of Grand Forks, Fargo-Moorhead, West Fargo, then many other industry groups, businesses, technology groups. And then following that page, you can see which states have in fact adopted this approach. So, Senator Sparks.
Thank you. And I'm curious, Senator Bonoff, this, and for members listening, this is essentially, this amendment is essentially Senate File 895.
Right.
There are a couple of changes. Maybe for members and folks in the audience, we could just highlight those changes from Senate File 895 and just add a little bit of clarity to what is being proposed here versus what is in 895.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sparks and Mr. Mendoza, I was under the impression it was 895.
I've been advised for some small changes.
Okay. Mr. Fuller, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, you're right. It is essentially 895 with two changes. On page 1, line 30, that clause B is new. That has to do with 911.
Oh, thank you.
And on page 2, line 8, clause 2 is reference was made to wholesale regulation. So those are the two changes.
Mr. Mendoza, would you like to speak to those changes at all?
Mr. Chair, Senators, nothing more other than kind of to what I said earlier, that we believe that these changes solidify and clarify that VoIP providers would have to comply with the state's 911 laws, and that it clarifies the PUC's authority to regulate wholesale services and interconnection in Minnesota.
All right. Well, thank you. And members, we can go a couple of different routes here. We are essentially adopting a bill that is on the agenda into this bill. And so if folks would like to hear testimony from members of the audience regarding Senate File 895, now may be an appropriate time to do that. The alternative would be to adopt this amendment, put both bills together essentially, and then move forward and hear testimony on both bills. I just don't know where the committee is in terms of support for one bill versus the other, so I would like to have some input there. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that we adopt Senate File 895, the amendment A4 to Senate File 736, so that when the testifiers come to the table, it would be very helpful if the testimony reflected the bill as amended before us. Sometimes it's confusing when testimony is to the bill, like prior to the amendment or such. So if we could have one bill in front of us as amended and then have testifiers address that, I think it'd be very helpful.
Okay. And this would be the A7 amendment that we're dealing with here for clarity.
Yes.
Any other thoughts on this? I just want to make sure that we're clear with what's happening here and make sure that there's an opportunity for... I have the A7 actually in front of me.
A7.
The A7 amendment to the A4.
Yeah.
All right. Any views, Senator Sparks? Is that how you'd like to proceed?
Chair, I think that's fair, and then I'd like to leave some time for some public testimony at the end, but I think it makes sense. Then we know what's in front of us, and I think then the opposition will be able to address it at that time.
Okay. All right. So we may not be voting on Senate File 895 separately. We're incorporating it into this bill essentially. Okay. Without any further discussion on that, Senator Sparks, I'm sorry.
Senator Nelson.
Senator Nelson moves the A7 amendment.
I moved the amendment.
All right. Senator Bonoff would move her own amendment, the A7 amendment, without further discussion.
Yeah.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
And then, Mr. Chairman, on your behalf, I would like to offer the A8 amendment at this time.
Staff is passing the amendment out. And Senator Sparks, I understand that we do have a slight technical change to the amendment that maybe Mr. Fuller can speak to.
Mr. Chair, on the amendment, the A8, maybe I'll wait a second until people get it. So. So on line 1.9, strike everything after condemnation and insert a period, and then strike everything on lines 10 and 11. That was always the intent. It was just dropped in transmission somehow. And the reason for striking those lines as well is it related to lines that are stricken further on, and they make no sense without the further language.
Sure. Perhaps we should move to incorporate that into the amendment. All right. And I will.
Senator Sparks.
Senator Sparks, would you like to incorporate the change as Mr. Fuller stated?
Yes, please.
Stated?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
All right. So that change has been incorporated into the A8 amendment. Senator Sparks, would you like to speak to this anymore? Would you like? I have a comment I could make to this.
Mr. Chairman, go ahead. I'm offering this on your behalf. So why don't you give a brief overview, and then we can vote on this amendment, and then hear some public testimony.
Thank you, Senator Sparks. Members and folks who are listening, Section 237.19 in our state law is actually over 100 years old, and I think this would have been an ideal candidate for inclusion in our UN-session last year. It relates to municipal telecom services and those municipalities that are investing in telephone exchanges or switches. Tends to be obsolete. We don't see this kind of investment anymore made in new builds or constructions. However, there is some language in here requiring a supermajority vote of 65% for acquisitions and projects to move forward. And this has caused a lot of uncertainty and barriers for those communities that are looking to partner with providers or cooperatives in such a manner as to improve their technology in their communities. And so we're not proposing removing 237.19, but rather to clarify that supermajority vote is not necessary. Again, I should just emphasize for folks that this technology, this telephone exchange, these switches are not invested in. This is obsolete language. Nonetheless, we thought that it would be best to just remove this reference to the supermajority. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, if this is not used anymore, why is it important to change from a supermajority to a majority for something that's obsolete?
Senator Nelson, thank you for the question. There are references to this section in other parts of the law, and also there are existing municipal telephone services that operate based upon this law. So we don't want to lead any unintended consequences by removing this section altogether. And so I will tell you, I've had an opportunity to reach out to various stakeholders on this, and Senator Sparks and other members of the committee. And the idea here was to include this in the conversation. What we're doing here today is essentially putting together a bit of a telecom omnibus bill here. And I think this is an important provision for us that plays off of our border-to-border broadband fund last year. Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair. So it just seems that if your intent is to change from a supermajority to a majority, that it would be better that that be in the actual language for which you would like to see that voting strength changed. But so my question would be then, to what other language does this obsolete bill refer that by adopting your amendment, there would no longer be required a supermajority, but it would be a simple majority. So to what else does this refer that makes it important to change from a supermajority to a majority?
I'll tell you, Senator Nelson, I appreciate the question. We're actually just trying to clean up this language. There's a lot of uncertainty as to whether or not this provision that relates to telephone exchanges has any broader implications. It's viewed as though it does not have broader implications, but we just want to offer additional clarity for those who are interested in this investment.
So, Mr. Nelson. Chair, so here's my question exactly. Does this change the passage requirement for a municipality that would like to own or operate an exchange within its borders? Does this change, particularly broadband, the voting requirement for any municipality to own or operate a broadband exchange? By extension, you're saying that this section of law regulates other sections of law. And so I want to know, how would this change that you're proposing today impact the vote requirement by a municipality in choosing to own or operate a broadband service or VoIP service or anything like that?
Senator Nelson, I'd like to address your question, but Mr. Fuller's been chomping at the bit here to add some clarity. So if we could give him the opportunity to speak, and I will address your question.
I'm no
thereafter.
Longer hungry. Yes. Well, let's just walk through the bill.
Yep.
So the first nine lines, or the amendment, the first nine lines, five, is an authorization. All right? It authorizes municipalities. There's nothing about a vote. I assume they could do it by their governing body. Whatever. All right. And then the language that we struck has two components. One is if you condemn it, and that language required a majority vote. So it required a vote. Nothing else requires a vote. So in that circumstance, you need a vote. And then if there's an existing exchange there, it requires a two-thirds vote. And so if it's not condemnation, and if it's not involving an existing exchange that's there, there is no vote requirement.
And Senator Nelson, I just add to your question that this pertains to telecom services, not broadband services. So this is 237 section in law or chapter in law regards to telephone. And that's why I bring this forward, and I do believe it should have been part of our unsession activities last year. They're specifically referencing a telephone exchange in the statute. We don't see those sorts of investments anymore. And so we just want to clarify this. This has caused a great deal of uncertainty in communities and in among stakeholders around the state. And it is clearly obsolete. It's 100 years old. And so that's why we make this motion today.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson, absolutely.
Thank you for that clarification. I will say I find it more confusing that we are amending a statute that is obsolete because it refers to other statutes. And so it's not clear in my mind really what the purpose or the intent of this is, or more importantly, what the unintended consequences might be. And so I am fearful that we might be changing, whether it be condemnation or setting up a new exchange or whatever this statute is related to, I'm fearful that we might be taking what is a supermajority required by a municipality down to just a regular majority. So I'm not going to be in favor of it for that reason. Not that I it's created more uncertainty in my mind.
And, Senator Nelson, I appreciate your line of questions. I just want to reiterate for the record and for members here, this is probably one of the two or three biggest points of feedback that I've received after establishment of our border-to-border broadband fund, that we have language in statute that provides more uncertainty than clarity. And this effort is to try to provide certainty. And I'd be happy to continue the conversation, you know, moving forward. I just think this is an important element of playing off of our border-to-border broadband fund and trying to get the most out of our state resources.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the A8 amendment.
Then. Senator Sparks moves the A8 amendment. Without any further discussion, all those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, I believe then we should allow now for some public testimony, maybe for the next 20 minutes or so, roughly. So I think that, in fairness to them, we should let Deputy Commissioner Grant and the Attorney General and maybe a few witnesses come forward at this
time. Very well. All right. Yes, and in the interest of time, if folks could approach the desk 2x2. And, sir, if you don't mind stating your name and proceeding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill Grant, Deputy Commissioner for Energy and Telecommunications at the Department of Commerce. And thank you for the opportunity to speak briefly on the bill. And I won't repeat the concerns that we raised both with Senate File 736 or with the bill that's been added to it. We have been working, as Senator Sparks knows, with the parties, particularly to the first of those two bills. I believe that progress has been made, although I would have to say that progress is not reflected in the bill that's in front of you. We are willing to continue working on this. I must say, though, that the addition of the VoIP language to the bill makes making progress more rather than less difficult in our view. And so I'm disappointed to see that combination of the two bills. There are also issues that we have recommended be a part of any telecommunications bill that you adopt this year that are in neither of these. And those deal with rural call completion issues, as well as bill transparency and service quality issues. Those have not been addressed to our satisfaction, and the bill, in the case of rural call completion, hasn't been addressed at all. So with that, Mr. Chairman, the Department of Commerce, as I said, is willing to continue working, but we do have some strong concerns about moving forward with the bill in this form.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate your feedback. If you don't mind stating your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is James Cannaday. I'm an Assistant Attorney General here from Minnesota Attorney General Lori Swanson's office. I'm the manager of the Residential Utilities and Antitrust Division at the office. The Attorney General's office is strongly opposed to this bill, and this bill is deregulation of the telecommunications industry in Minnesota. You've been told earlier it's not, and I would suggest that puts you in a difficult position because you're being told two different things that couldn't be more opposed from each other, and I want to be very clear that I'm not saying that lightly. This is deregulation, and I will try to explain to you briefly, because I know we're rushed today, why it is deregulation and what it will do to consumers. But I would suggest that that does put you in a difficult spot because there's limited ability to get information and clarity on that at this point. I can't resolve that dispute, but I can be clear that the Attorney General's office is saying it's deregulation. And I just want to briefly note before I try to get into the specifics that AARP is opposed to the bill, Legal Aid is opposed to the bill. I hope we have time to hear from some of those groups today. AFL-CIO is opposed to the bill. And we don't view this as a wordsmithing problem or a compromise issue where we're maybe halfway there. We view this bill as entirely inappropriate and bad for consumers and ratepayers. I did have a handout that I hope we can pass out, but I'll start trying to explain it as it's being handed out.
Mr. Chair, can I make one comment?
Senator Nelson.
Could you make sure that your testimony refers only to the bill as amended?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
And members, I will make sure that I do that going forward, and everything I have said so far also does address the amendments that were adopted today.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to clarify that. Do we have the handout, can I ask?
I'm told that the handout is in the packet, members, so
okay.
If you have it, here it is.
I apologize for that confusion.
So please proceed.
So I will be brief with the handout because I would like to make some additional points after this, but the only clarification that I need to make based on the amendments that were adopted today in terms of the handout is on the first page of the handout. Obviously, the handout I brought with me applied to the version that was in place before the amendments today. The language that I've highlighted is still in the bill as amended today, but it now appears in Section 5 rather than Section 1 as reflected on the first page of the handout here. The language in Section 5 is slightly different, but the highlighted portions remain in the new version. What I'd like to draw your attention to is that the reason this is deregulation is the bill governs ILEX, the incumbent local exchange carriers, under CLEC rules, which are the highlighted rules there, 7811 and 7812-2210, after this bill would be passed. The following pages in the handout then look at what that means in the Minnesota rules that currently govern CLECs, the competitive local exchange carriers. So you'll see that the PUC would lose authority to review and approve prices under this bill. And we've highlighted the section of the rule that governs that.
Mr. Chair, do you want questions now or later?
Sir Nelson, if you'd like to proceed with the question,
yeah,
go ahead.
I do. I want to know the difference between prior approval and approval. So you said approval. However, the legislation says prior approval. Is there any significance in that?
Well, Mr. Kennedy.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members. Currently, for an ILEC, the way that a price increase would work is the phone company would file a proposed tariff with the Public Utilities Commission. That would go through an approval process, and a price would be approved by the Public Utilities Commission. And I, in the interest of answering this briefly, which I might not do a great job of doing, I'm speaking of the process under rate of return regulation. Most phone companies today are governed under alternative form of regulation, which is also currently in statute. That would be a slightly different process, but still the Public Utilities Commission approves the price in advance. Under the bill that's proposed here, prices could be changed by the phone companies unilaterally. They would be required to provide notice to customers. That's actually reflected on page 3 of my handout. The Public Utilities Commission would retain some ability to disprove price increases that were found to be inappropriate, but they would not have rate-setting authority as they do now. They would simply be able to disprove prices and price changes by CLEX or ILEX in the future.
Sir Nelson.
So the PUC would retain authority to not approve price hikes?
Mr. Candidate.
Mr. Chair and members, I actually wouldn't agree with the way you're phrasing it, and I know it's a fine distinction, but the PUC would be able to PUC would be able to affect some ability to cancel price changes that they found to be in violation of the law after the fact, but they would not be able to directly set prices under this bill and the proposed law. Does that provide clarification?
Sir Nelson?
Actually, it sounds like you're wordsmithing a bit. Continue on.
I appreciate it, and hopefully I'm able to clarify it as I go on. I don't want to give the impression that that's a minor difference from our point of view, though, because currently the Public Utilities Commission has the ability to set prices, which means we leave that in the hands of the body with authority and expertise in this to strike the best balance between what the phone company wants and what's best for consumers, small businesses, and ratepayers everywhere throughout the state.
Senator Ames,
thank
you for
Mr.
question.
Chair, and I want to go back to Senator Nelson's question and to the testifier. As I understand, the bill allows you to approve prices, so it's really kind of a simple yes or no question. Can you approve prices? Yes or no. It's just that simple. Do you approve the prices? Yes or no?
Mr. Candidate.
That's simple.
Mr. Chair and members, well, first of all, when you say do I, the Attorney General's office does not currently, would not in the future. And to the extent you're asking if the Public Utilities Commission would approve prices in the future, the answer is no. The Public Utilities Commission would not approve prices in the future if this bill were passed.
But they could disapprove.
Senator Dames.
But they can disapprove. Is that correct?
Mr. Candidate?
They could strike a price increase by a phone company and force them to go back and make another submission or proposal for a new price. But they could not set prices directly. Currently, they are able to set prices directly.
Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair, to the testifier, I think you're saying the same thing as I just asked you. You can disapprove a price, yes or no? Not you, but the Public Utilities Commission. It's really a simple question, yes or no.
Mr. Chair, members,
Mr.
The public
Candidate.
Yes, the Public Utilities Commission can disapprove a price,
thank
but
you.
Cannot
That's
set
what I,
a price
that was what I
in its place.
Thank you.
I'm going to make another couple of points here. The handouts, I hope, are self-explanatory and will help in directing you to the rules that we think are problematic. But let me address how this hurts consumers. We've been talking about prices, and obviously I think the ability of phone companies to unilaterally set prices is harmful to consumers. We think that price regulation is probably the most important consumer protection that currently exists in law. But there are other problems we haven't talked about, so let me briefly address them, and then I'll hopefully leave time for others to testify as well. First, as to the carrier of last resort issues, Ms. Rice addressed that earlier when she was testifying in support of the bill. I just want to make clear we do not agree with the carrier of last resort analysis that was provided earlier. The last page of my handout does highlight the carrier of last resort provisions that are currently in law in Minnesota. And those provisions would not remain applicable to ILECs under this bill. And we do have concerns that carriers would not be obligated to provide service or, critically, to provide affordable service to everybody in the state of Minnesota. And I think there's a tendency for all of us to take this concept for granted. I would suggest it's because we've all lived in a state where there have been carrier of last resort protections. We're accustomed to the fact that if we want our phone company to take us on as a customer, they will do so, and they'll do so at an affordable price. And that is not going to be the future. It won't be a guaranteed future if this bill is passed. Finally, just a few words to service quality, because that's the third major concern that we have.
Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before you move on, I do have a question. It's a little unclear to me when you were talking about the carriers of last resort. On the one hand, I thought I heard you say the Attorney General did not believe that the carrier of last resort protections apply in providing service, but then you kind of changed it to say providing affordable service. Now, there's a difference there. And I want to clarify, the carrier of last resort protections apply for service, but I think you're saying you don't think they apply for affordable service. Is that correct?
Mr. Candidate.
Mr. Chair, members, my answer to that, to be direct, is we raise both concerns. I was trying to raise both concerns and not switch from one to the other in my answer. Certainly, it's clear that we're concerned that it won't be affordable, and that is a carrier of last resort issue going forward. But beyond that, we're concerned that the law as written does not apply all of those carrier of last resort protections to phone companies. And let me be specific. 237.011, 237.06, 237.09, subdivisions 1 and 2, and 237.16, subdivisions 1, 3, 6, and 7. Do not appear in this bill and do not appear that they would be applicable to ILECs if this bill were passed.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. So would any of those provisions that you say no longer apply, would any of those, would the lack of those provisions allow a someone not to provide service? We're talking about service here, providing service. is there anything in those 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 areas that you said would no longer apply that would exempt the provision of service, the assurity that service was there, was available?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, that's exactly what we're saying. The concern is that the combination of those laws is what currently requires phone carriers in the state of Minnesota, the incumbent phone carriers in the state of Minnesota, to offer service to everyone in their service territory. And without those sections being specifically applicable, it would become a business decision for the phone companies as to whether they're going to continue offering service in their territories. Now, that could be on a global basis. I mean, that could be a CenturyLink territory in northern Minnesota as a whole that has that concern. It could be a particular town. I could imagine this coming up in terms of if repairs were required to a certain trunk line that goes to whatever the farthest town is on this hypothetical trunk line. It becomes a business decision as to whether we're going to make those repairs and continuing offering service to everyone, or if we're going to stop offering service to a particular area. And most likely, it could become a decision as to an individual customer. It could become a business decision as to whether they want to continue offering service to a particular customer. Now, that could be as to whether the customer has maybe made one too many requests to the phone company for billing disputes or something like that. It could be, again, a repair issue, a dollars and cents issue. It could be a number of things, but it will no longer be required that service be offered to everybody.
Mr. Chair, we'll need some clarification on that. That's not what we heard earlier. So at some point, we'll need to get that clarified. Thank you.
Would you like to proceed? Mr. Chair, members, that's not what you heard earlier, and that goes to the heart of the problem that I think you're facing. Finally, and very briefly, service quality, because, again, I think this is an important issue, and we haven't been talking as much about this one today. There are currently service quality provisions that are in both Chapter 237 and Chapter 7810 of the Minnesota Rules. Critically, some of today's service protections are also embodied in the phone company's alternative forms of regulation. And under this bill, the phone companies will no longer be regulated under those alternative forms, or A4s as they're called. And so that's one way in which service quality is threatened with this bill. Maybe the more direct way is, I want to mention, there is a pending proceeding at the Public Utilities Commission that was brought by CenturyLink to dismantle the service quality rules. And so this fight is going on in multiple fronts. The Attorney General's office is opposing that vigorously at the Public Utilities Commission currently. We very much have a situation here whereby one way or another, from our view, the phone companies are doing what they can legislatively and at the administrative bodies to degrade the service quality protections. And to the extent that's happening here in this bill, we also want to point that out. I'd be happy to answer any further questions, but again, in the interest of time, I'll leave my comments there.
Thank you, sir. Yes, please, Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one point or question, Mr. Kennedy. Since this bill was presented and laid over, did you participate in the different working group meetings that were held since then?
Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Chair, members, the Attorney General's office did not ever meet with CenturyLink, is what I would say as a preliminary answer to your question. And the reason I answer it that way is because certainly we have been talking with many of the groups that are part of this. We've been talking with AARP, Legal Aid, the Department of Commerce, and others about our concerns. So we've had many meetings about the bill and the concerns, but we haven't met with the industry groups. We weren't invited to meet with the industry groups. We were not ever approached by the industry groups before this bill was introduced. Does that answer your question?
Well, yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Because it's my understanding that the department was invited, so that's why your answer surprises me a little bit.
Mr. Chair, members, that's my understanding too. Obviously, the department's here and they can speak for themselves. But my understanding is the department was invited, and I can certainly say that we were not invited to participate.
Senator Nelson, do you have a follow-up?
Just two quick questions. One, did you visit with the bill author? about your concerns or the Attorney General's concerns? And then secondly, is there any ongoing litigation by the Attorney General's office in regards to any of these things? A few weeks ago, we had Senator Bonhoff is not here, but a few weeks ago, we had a bill in higher education from the Attorney General's office on disclosure for private colleges, and yet we found out that there was no disclosure that this was a bill that was being or a case that was being litigated by the Attorney General's office. So, is there any litigation that the Attorney General's office is currently engaged in that relates to this bill that's before us today,
Mr. Candidate?
Mr. Chair, members, to answer both your questions, first of all, I personally have not met with Senator Sparks, but I know that I believe I was here in front of you a month ago today, if I'm remembering my dates right, and I know that the Attorney General's office was in contact with Senator Sparks' office in advance of that first hearing to advise him and his office of the opposition to the bill. And as to your second question of litigation related to this matter, not aware of litigation in the state or federal court system on this issue. Certainly there are a number of telecom issues that are ongoing at the Public Utilities Commission, and that's the area where the division that I'm a member of is involved in a number of matters. We're directly involved in the rulemaking proceeding that I mentioned earlier about the service quality rules that's been going on for, I believe, maybe a year or more at the Public Utilities Commission. That's directly in the area that we're talking about today. We also deal with consumer complaints in this area on an ongoing basis, and we do receive a number of consumer complaints about both traditional telecom issues and VoIP issues.
Okay. Senator Dames.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Kennedy. I'm a little disappointed in the fact that you knew when we had the bill here last time you were here, I believe you testified, and the bill was laid over so that the stakeholders could all get together and try to work some things out. Yet, by your own admittance, you didn't meet with the stakeholders, the phone companies. You didn't meet with the author of the bill. But you did spend time meeting with the people opposed to the bill. And I guess I'm quite surprised today that you're coming back and hadn't tried to do anything in order to help the folks make this a better bill and to work with them to take care of some of your objectives. So I'm a little concerned and rather disappointed in the fact that the Attorney General's office handled it that way.
Mr. Chair, Candidate. Members, I'd certainly appreciate the opportunity to respond to that. I was here a month ago to express the concerns that we knew of at that time, and the Attorney General's office has done a great deal since that time in relation to this bill. And we are fighting this bill, and we're fighting it strongly. This is not a bill where we see an easy fix, as I mentioned at the beginning. This is not a bill where we see meetings regarding wordsmithing to be a good use of our time. This is a deregulation bill that is going to harm consumers and ratepayers, and we are trying to do what we think is right in the forums we think are right.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, members? Maybe we can get some additional testimony in the room today. Thank you, Mr. Candidate. Thank you, Mr. Grant. Anyone else like to approach the desk? I think we have Judy Schaffhausen, Patricia Cram, and Ann Banyan. And I know these are very important issues that merit great discussion, but we are running out of time. There's a committee that will be coming in here starting at 4 p.m. here shortly. So if you don't mind stating your name for the record and proceeding.
Yes, I'm Judy Schaffhausen, and I'm here to testify in strong opposition to the Senate bill of 736. In 2004, I had a pacemaker put into my heart. And at that point, my heart doctor stated to me that I could not lose my landline. I transmit my data every 3 months to my heart doctor. And they usually respond with a letter or a callback letting me know that things are going well. Just had a new battery put in last year, and that should take me another 10 years down the road. Okay. I don't like the fact that I'd have to travel into Minneapolis 3 times in the year. The once a year is enough. And I appreciate listening to my story. I've got many friends that have pacemakers, and we all have to dial in our hearts. I don't know if there's going to be a way that they can change that or not. But I'm sure that they're willing and ready for whatever happens in the future. The only problem is that most of them are senior citizens. We're all on fixed incomes. And, of course, we don't want to see any price rates going up because of our age and because we have to have this pacemaker. So that's all I have for today, and I appreciate your time listening to my story.
Well, thank you for your testimony. Sarah Nelson, would you like to add?
Thank you, Ms. Schaffhausen, for that great testimony. And we know that telemedicine is going to continue to be more and more important, and I can guarantee you that I will be working to make sure that people like you and my mother-in-law, who has a pacemaker and dials in just like you do, continue to have that ability to do so. That is essential. And thank you for bringing that to our attention.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you again for your testimony. All right, ma'am, if you'd like to state your name and proceed.
Yes, my name is Ann Banyan, and I'm a resident of Golden Valley here in Hennepin County. And I'm a voter, and I'm a good taxpayer in good standing. I just want to speak to this bill, saying that I am in very strong opposition to the 736. And I have more questions, I think, than I do have concrete. I'm listening to all of the everything having to do with the language and so on, but I have more questions than anything about the bill. From my calculations, there's about 5.4 million people in Minnesota, 87 counties. About 3 million people live outside the Twin Cities area. Many of these people in these areas can't afford a cell phone, but they can afford a landline under the current structure. Many of these people in these 85 counties, they don't even have cell phone service. So that issue of being a competitive service, there isn't a competitive service for them. There's a reason why it's regulated. It's a monopoly. The hurdle to enter the landline business is prohibitive. No one would be entering into it. And everyone needs to have a reliable phone service at a reasonable cost. That's why it was regulated. And when AT&T broke up in the 80s, the local operating companies, that's what they were called at the time, took the regulated portion, and that included the landline business. So before deciding to deregulate, I just have some questions. What's happened in these other states that have been deregulated? From what I've read, and the costs have gone up and the service down as much as 250% or 238%, I think it was, in California. The population is aging on fixed incomes, as you mentioned. And what do people do after deregulation and the cost goes up and maybe they can't afford the service anymore? Then what do they do? And if they don't have a cell service, that's going to be a problem. And what are the cost-effective, assured, reliable alternatives to a landline? If they don't have cell service, then what are they going to do? I know some counties are looking into an alternative, but they aren't there yet. And I don't know, they have no idea when they will be there. And if they don't have cell service and they don't have a landline, becomes too expensive, is the state going to then step in? And will the taxpayers then foot the bill for some kind of an alternative method for these people to communicate? And what's the plan if they don't get service? What is the plan for them right now? And medical emergencies, like we're talking about, 911 is a problem. So what do these people do? For people that have medical monitoring, they're blind, they can't see a cell phone. My mother was blind. She couldn't use a cell phone if her life depended on it. She had to feel the numbers. She couldn't see to punch them in. And caregivers, with people that are taking care of people with Alzheimer's and heart disease and diabetes, and people in need of dialing 911 for an emergency that lives in a building that's got multiple apartments, because dialing 911 is not going to locate that. Only a landline will locate that exact position.
Ms. Banyan, if I could just add, we are running out of time. We appreciate your testimony, but if you're able to conclude in the coming minutes.
All I want to say is that I think it's an important issue. And before approving deregulation, I think some of these questions should be answered.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I call the question.
All right. Sergeant Dames has called the question. Is there any discussion or comments?
We can't do that. It's against the rules.
We can't. Okay. I'm trying to break the rules. I'm sorry.
We can move to vote. That's fine.
Sergeant Dames, would you permit me to make one comment before we move forward?
Absolutely.
You will?
Sure.
All right. Thank you. Well, members, and Senator Sparks, I appreciate you bringing these bills to us today. And, you know, this is an issue that I'm very interested in. I think there's very few things that we do up here that are more important than trying to align our policy with rapidly changing technology. You look at broadband and the services that are operated and offered on it throughout the state and the country and the world, so important to 21st century life and economic development and opportunity. And, you know, I regret the process that we're following here. These are important discussions that we need to be having, and this committee needs to be having. And I think that there's a lot that we can do to educate ourselves and to have more thorough discussions moving forward. And as you look at the regulatory environment, you know, when it comes to broadband or telecom services, you know, obviously we're not on the same page in terms of how we regulate telephone services versus broadband and VoIP. And we want to align that regulation to be consistent to our providers, to our customers. And obviously we need to look to the FCC and the federal government to do a better job of that. I think they've taken some steps recently to improve the way we're regulating this service and this technology. And I fear that what we're doing in Minnesota may be going in the opposite direction. And I think it's very important for us to be thoughtful in what we do and to not take piecemeal approaches to this policy, but rather to look at it holistically. And so with that, I have some reservations both with the process and the policy that we're moving forward. I know that this, if it prevails, will be moving on to the Finance Committee and the conversation will continue. But I just implore this committee and members of the legislature to really give these issues additional thought. The concerns that we hear out here are very real, and there's a reason why we've received a lot of contacts from our constituents and others over the past several weeks. I hope that we're able to spend more time moving forward on these issues because they're so important in 21st century life. So with that said, Senator Sparks, you have a final word.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And members, I appreciate the attention that you've paid to this bill. You know, we've now had two public hearings and numerous meetings just this year to air the issues and work through the provisions. I've been working on this for the last 4 or 5 years, and I think many of you know that this is not my style. We like to try to get some consensus. Unfortunately, in this area, we just are not able to get there yet. I'm a rural member of the Senate, as many of you know, and I would never move forward with legislation that would take away my constituents, friends, or neighbors' landline service, or many of the other things that have been suggested that result from this bill. Members, I think we have a good product in front of you. If this bill moves forward today, we'll go to the Finance Committee and continue to have discussions. I would like to thank the Department of Commerce, AARP, and Legal Aid because they have been at the table. I have some discrepancies with what the Attorney General has had to say today, but we'll save that for another day. So, Mr. Chair, I will move that Senate File 736 as amended be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance.
All right. Senator Sparks has made his motion. Without further discussion, all those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. No. The amendment prevails. Motion adopted. And that completes. I'm sorry. The motion prevails, and the bill as amended is referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And that concludes the work of our committee. The meeting is adjourned.